Caroline Cornwall Census. She's lectured on the Cornish in New Zealand, organized a genealogical tour of Cornwall. She received the Paul Smales Award in 1993, and she will be telling us about the farthest promised land for the Cornish, settlement in New Zealand.
French New Zealand was actually only 5 days away from being a French colony, and because the British Crown thought that the Maori people needed protection, they annexed the islands of New Zealand. And the Treaty of Waitangi was signed on the 6th of February 1840 between the British Crown and the Maori chiefs. And this treaty was necessary so that the British citizens would have British immigrants would have citizenship rights, and it enabled the land transactions between the Crown and Maori to proceed legally. It also meant that initially most immigrants would be from the British Isles. Now, the Cornishman Reverend William Wombe, he was a witness at the signing of the treaty, and he and the other missionaries had found the Maori living community. They built high strategic settlements where they were threatened by intertribal warfare, and they used the rivers and the coastal waterways as highways, and they were quite a mobile people depending on their time of year for their harvest and also because of intertribal warfare. And William Wombe was rather appalled to discover that cannibalism was still practiced. So that was New Zealand before organised settlement began. Meanwhile, back in Britain, we were having a massive planned movement of labour from one side of the world to the other. It resulted, as you know, in depopulation. and inevitable separation of families. And it was fostered by central government, but it was also fostered by at the local parish level. And I have found some entries from the Red Roof Union Workhouse Admission Registers, which I thought was very interesting. This is for the September quarter of 1842. It was Richard Scandling, a miner off Camborne, and his wife Mary and their 5 children in the workhouse. And the notes say, preparing them for immigration to New Zealand. They left with the Gribble family as well. And another note says, the Gribbles and the Scandlings were going to be sent to Plymouth in a van by Mr. Uren to embark Purdy Essex, the name of the ship, for New Zealand. They were going to have their victuals paid for them until the 30th of August, and they were described as Scandlings as a very well-respected and industrious family. John Gribble, however, was described as a decided pauper who has long been a burden to the parish. Then there was George and Mary Ridley, who together, it says, with E. Ridley, left the workhouse in the same quarter to embark for New Zealand. Then it says, Mary Ridley married to Davy and immigrated to New Zealand, George having died at Plymouth prior to embarkation. Now, there was a woman who didn't want to miss an opportunity. She had her bags packed for New Zealand, despite the fact that when her husband number one died, she immediately found husband number two. We'll find out how they got on in New Zealand a little bit later. Well, New Zealand offered opportunities for land. That was the big draw card. It offered regular employment, perhaps a healthier lifestyle. There was opportunities for mining in coal and gold and copper. And it gave you the opportunity to improve your status. And I also think for the Cornish it was another chance for adventure. It didn't offer any sort of infrastructure. So the first settlers had to clear the land before it could be farmed. The swamps needed draining, roads needed building, homes and bridges needed to be built, and churches, schools and businesses established. And transport was by coastal vessel, or by the rivers, or simply you walked. Now there were 3 main patterns of immigration during the initial founding period of 1840 to 1818. We can just go through these very quickly. In 1840, they were based on the belief of the New Zealand Company and a man called Edward Gibbon Wakefield, who had quite sort of socialist ideas, and they thought that all the problems in Britain could be solved by basically exporting the excess population. They also had a strong belief that you could create a new settlement by encouraging people to come who could afford to pay for the land. And when they paid for the land, and often was sight unseen, some of them didn't actually ever leave England, the capitalist investors, they would then use the money to bring out the labouring classes who would do all the work. And they really wanted to transplant and soil. Well, it was really hard to sell New Zealand to start off with. Who would want to take a 100-day voyage down the west coast of Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope, across the bottom of the Indian Ocean, to arrive to Australia or New Zealand? Those voyages were 100 days or more, and you could take a 10-day voyage here to America, which was cheaper, and America was a bit more settled. So they sent, the New Zealand company thought, what are we going to do here? So they sent their agents, or dream merchants, as I like to call them, to target specific areas where they thought there were men with the skills they needed, the carpenters and the blacksmiths and the agricultural labourers. Now, Sir William Molesworth of Pencarrow Estate near Bodmin, he was a member of Parliament at this time and a great supporter of the New Zealand company. He had a brother called Francis, so he persuaded Francis to head for New Zealand, and Francis took with him a band of people from Cornwall. And because the New Zealand company was so anxious to get their settlements up and running, there were four of them planned to be set up before 1842, that woman who Nelson, New Plymouth and Wellington. They had sent out the surveyors in 1839, but the surveyors really had no understanding of what lay ahead of them. So they hadn't done any of the surveying, so by the time the people arrived at Wellington, they didn't get the land that was promised to them initially. So they set up camp on the beach and had the local Maori build them houses out of flax and reeds. And the Cornish amongst them called that little row of houses along the beach Cornish Row. Now, can you imagine their anguish when a few weeks later, 14 of those cottages burned to the ground in 20 minutes? Unfortunately, no lives were lost, but then they had their first experience of an earthquake shortly after, and for the second time, the river flooded. So I don't think life was as they thought it would be. Now, in Francis Molesworth's party was a carpenter from Nangliru, Hartiudi, and his wife Jane, and they'd come out with their four children who were under the age of six. Now, can you imagine how you would keep four children under the age of six occupied and safe on a vessel for 4 months? They left in the October and they didn't arrive until the February of 1841. Now, Jane was 3 months pregnant with her fifth child when they set out. When she arrived on that beach, she had to cook and wash and clean and keep her eye on those children only yards from the sea. So their fifth child, Thomas Kimmitsudi, was duly delivered safely in May under an upturned lifeboat on the beach. Now 7 years later, the sea did claim one of their children when Joseph died, drowned, aged 2.5. But they left Cornwall because they were concerned about their future and the future for their children, and that family prospered and did well. Further down the island in New Plymouth, again, the company there had been slow in getting the surveying off the ground. It took a year for a bullock team to make its way up from Wellington, so it could help with dragging the logs out of the bush. However, some people did very well, and William Henwood wrote home to his parents in St. Germans. He said, "I have got a very good situation as foreman of the company's carpenters. I have £150 per year with 10 men to work for me and 2 apprentices. We found some lime rock and plenty of minerals such as iron and copper. This is a splendid country when the land is cleared. Mine was the first wheat harvest in the country. I have one section of land in town and 3 dwelling houses. They bring me in 24 shillings a week. I've got the first cow in the country, a nanny goat, 1 pig, a dog, and 2 cats. And best of all, I have got a nice little wife, a merry one and a clever one too." Now letters like this, the historian James Village describes as boosterism. And when they were published in the papers back home in Cornwall, the New Zealand company was delighted because it encouraged chain migration. Now just a quick mention about those families that were in the recruited Red Workhouse. They did very well because the 1846 police census in New Plymouth says that lists Richard Scanlon as being the owner and occupier of a cottage. Mary Gribble is living in a house with James Shaw, no sign of husband John Gribble. And there is an L.H. Davy listed as owning 3 dwellings. So if he was the Davy that Mary Ridley married, didn't she make the right choice? But all was not well for the miners in New Plymouth. Despite William Edward influence of optimism. There were no viable mining opportunities. So they had to be taken by boat up to Auckland to work with the copper mines on Power Island, which Philip mentioned on Wednesday evening. But some of those families went without their men because five of the Cornishmen had become so impatient that they walked the 250 miles from New Plymouth to Auckland. And they were joined by copper miners from Australia who had heard about the mine and come over to join them. 1852 to 1876, we had the provincial scheme, and each of those provinces had their own schemes. There was one called the 40 Acre Scheme, which meant that every adult that could pay their own fare to New Zealand was entitled to 40 acres, and if you had a child over the age of 5, you were entitled to a further 20 acres. So it paid reasonably comfortably off Cornish to come out and participate in that scheme. There was also mining work available for the tunnellers who worked on the Christchurch Railway Tunnel, and then of course the gold rushes came. And many of the miners that came to New Zealand had been here in California, they moved to Australia, and then come on to New Zealand. And then the last one is the New Zealand, the central government launched a vast scheme to develop the infrastructure of New Zealand, and that's when the most Cornish arrived. We have, as Philip also mentioned, 5,240 Cornish were registered as coming during the 1870s and 1880s. And they had been recruited most part by John Brogdon and Sons, and they were described as navvies. The three essential things about this scheme was that it was nomination. So you could come out and then you could turn around and nominate some members of your family to come out as well. So Samuel Prisk came out with his wife and two children, and he turned around and nominated 12 more Prisks to come out, and they arrived 6 months later. Single women were also encouraged to come out to right the imbalance between men and women caused by the gold rushes, and elderly parents were encouraged to come because it was thought that they made for more stable families. So therefore, the Cornish came to New Zealand and they contributed largely to our nation building because they came from a country where technology was valued, where they also had experience in agriculture, so they were well prepared for the rugged pioneering that New Zealand needed. And they knew the sea. So therefore, a long sea voyage didn't daunt them. They knew more about overseas countries, probably, than they did up country. And we're very grateful to them, and I'm looking forward to sharing more of these stories with you.